Welcome to an all-new episode of the McFuture Podcast. I'm Steve Factor. I have a bunch of these deep dive type episodes that I've been putting out, but there's just not enough time to do one every week. So I wanted to do something profound, but also didn't take forever to finish. So I put together a few things that I didn't think were related, but actually are. And the overarching theme is, what the F are we? It'll make sense in a second. Let's start with the first thing. There's a thing called deep fakes. I don't know if you've heard of these things, but basically, there's a way to pretty much fake anything, right? You can show a video of Trump or Obama talking. You could do audio that matches perfectly what the person sounds like and how they talk, but put completely different words into their mouth. Now, the implications of this are insane because you can start a war if someone credible or semi-credible puts out a video that's Trump announcing nuclear strikes on Russia or whoever. You could imagine all kinds of doomsday scenarios that could be created. And as stupid as people have become, now they're all reactionaries. No one waits for a story to be confirmed. Every imbecile on Twitter, as soon as something fits their narrative, immediately starts tweeting it, formulating opinions. I mean, the opinions are already formulated. Everything that happens in the world is more like a supermarket where you decide which things to put into your cart to back up your worldview. And this kind of stuff, oh my God, this can spread so easily because there's so many dumb people with lots of followers. So look for that at your nearest bomb shelter because incoming, we are exposed. There's a video online and I'll put it in the show notes. Joe Rogan, who's obviously a very famous podcaster and comedian and has got all kinds of other titles, some company put out a video of Joe saying completely insane things.
I've decided to sponsor a hockey team made up entirely of chimps. I'm tired of people telling me that chimps are not capable of kicking human ass in sports. Chimps are just superior athletes. And these chimps have been working out hard. They're throwing kettlebells, battle ropes, everything. I've got them on a strict diet of bone broth and elk meat. These chimps will rip your balls off.
It sounds exactly like he would say it if you listen to the show. This is now out there. People have to be extra diligent. Now, these computer scientists at USC, they figured out a way to detect deep fakes with 96% accuracy. Of course, the 4% is where the enraged mob in Kashmir tears your neighbor apart limb from limb. Because they showed a video of him, stealing your goat or making love to it or something. It's a project that's been funded by DARPA, which funds all these crazy military technologies. If you're a big believer in conspiracy theories and aliens, then DARPA is part of your conspiracy melange. Conspiracies sound so much better when they're French, don't they? You know, aside from nuclear apocalypse, there's some positive things that'll come out of this. Deep fakes are going to be a huge industry. There's going to be all kinds of services protecting individuals and celebrities and corporations from fakes, but also in the entertainment industry. I mentioned this briefly in one of the Future of Media episodes. Your movie stars don't have to be alive anymore. In fact, the dead ones show up on time. They don't expect lunch. They can work 24/7. They are the perfect employees. And we're getting to a point where you can't even tell. So it's just a matter of time before we have Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe starring in Star Wars, The Corpse Awakens. Or the original Medea before she passed away and Tyler Perry had to bravely take over her role. Or How to Train Your Dragon, starring original dragons like the ones that used to live back in the old days, like when Game of Thrones was real. That was real, right? That's biographical. Where you're going to have all kinds of dead pop stars. Already that's happening with the hologram tours. Who's the drug addict woman who died? The really skinny one? Amy Winehouse. That's who I was thinking about. Ronnie James Dio, who's a famous metal performer, he's going on a 3D tour. I mean, Michael Jackson would go on a 3D tour, but then he'd need like a 3D security guard to make sure he doesn't come near the kids. I mean, there is going to be a huge industry. Even fake parents. Like, you don't need real parents. Like, if you have a babysitting monitor, can you imagine your kid is laying there and a little hologram of the parents comes up and tells them, oh, no, no, stop picking your nose. Oh, no, you better stop spitting up. That could be like a really interactive and somewhat creepy babysitting service. You could also have interactive fantasy sports. You know how many people are playing all of these games, trying to pretend to be owners or managers of teams and making all these moves? Look, it's fun, or it's a gambling addiction. Whichever it is, there is a way to personalize it even further. Now the players can have a relationship with them. You know, God knows they're not getting laid, so at least have a conversation with your favorite pitcher. And you could even have these deep fake museum guides. Imagine you walk into the Sistine Chapel and Michelangelo gives you the tour. How awesome would that be? Or you could have a bitter Vincent van Gogh go apeshit in the middle of his tour when he finds out how much his paintings are selling for now, even though he died poor and earless. I think it's going to be a huge job boom, at the very least a big startup technology boom. Speaking of which, there was a company called Cameo that just raised $50 million for delivering personalized messages from celebrities and influencers. And I'm thinking the future of these personalized messages isn't going to be from celebrities and influencers. This is a licensing play. This is a way to say, hey, Snoop Dogg or a celebrity housewife, and say, hey, listen, you don't have to do a thing. We're going to scan your face and your body. We're going to take samples of your voice and let us use this for music, for videos, for sponsorships, or these messages where celebrities pretend to be your friends. That could all be licensed out now. You don't need the actual celebrity's participation. Is it really too much to ask for to have a virtual Jada Pinkett Smith wrap her arms around you and pretend to be your friend, just so you have something to post on social media and show that your life was worth living somehow? And there is a monetary value to it. Exactly how big it is, it's hard to know, but we're not that far from AI taking all that stuff over. There's another controversy related to this that came up, which is deep nudes. Yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. You can take a picture of a person, any person, and AI will automatically get them naked, strip them naked. Now, it's not their real body. Their algorithm figures out what is the best body that would fit that particular person. Now, personally, I mean, it would be such an honor if someone considered doing this of me. I mean, really, it is, it's a sign that at the very least someone wants to have sex with you. So that's the plus side. The bad side is this can get very creepy very fast and you start bumping up against the ethics of this. What are the ethics? Now, the developer of the software took it down, but of course it's the internet. So all of these other people have made copies of the software. Now they're charging $20 and they took out the watermark that shows that it's a fake. So now it looks like it's real. So you can expect this flood of celebrity videos and photos into the marketplace of them doing God knows what. How do you regulate that? The one thing that's pretty consistent is people are pervs. And once again, porn leads the way. It's led the way in payments. It's led the way in streaming photos and storage and hosting and all kinds of other places. So once again, the genitals win. I feel like there's a sports team that should be called the Genitals, and they're always winning because so many decisions are taking place solely on the basis of what genitals want. I know there's movies called What Women Want, What Men Want. What do the genitals want? That's the movie everyone wants to see. You don't even need a movie. It's everything around us. You know, porn is just the digital version of the thing that's driving us offline, which is a desire to spread our seed, which is a survival mechanism, right? Because there's survival of you and your body. There's survival of your family and your community. And then there's your kids, which is a survival of your seed and your bloodline. Those are things that are programmed not just into humans, but into every living thing. And now that survival need is being satiated by something fake online. Why do you think sex is dropping like a brick among teens and 20-somethings and 30-somethings? One of the reasons for that is we found digital substitutes. And the substitutes just keep getting better and better and better. So there's the external ethics, right, on the production side, which is, okay, should we be producing this? Should we be regulating this? And then on the consumption side, should I be doing this? Not for any religious or moral reason, but what are you getting out of it? And is that the best thing for you? And scale that up, is that the best thing for us as a society? Speaking of deep fakes and fake celebrities, I'm sure you remember in September, Nike came out with the Colin Kaepernick ad campaign, which is them basically monetizing police shootings. I've never really thought about it that way, but in essence, they're the only ones to find a way to make money off of it. If you're looking at it from a marketing perspective, it was brilliant, right? Because there's this person who is a hot potato in his league. No one wanted to put him on their team, but he had all of this media momentum and he had all of this goodwill among people who follow him and badwill among those who didn't. So that got a big splash back when it came out in September. Well, it happened again. Now, this time, Nike got even luckier because not only did they not have to even put out a product, they didn't even have to put out an ad. They basically just had to pay a graphic designer to put Betsy Ross's flag on a pair of sneakers. As soon as they announced that they were doing it, their own spokesperson, Colin Kaepernick, goes, oh, no, you can't release this. It would be incredibly hard for me to believe that a company like Nike that did that whole campaign with Kaepernick and even signing him up in the first place in any capacity after the controversy, there's like a 0% chance that they didn't think through all of the possible ramifications of a flag that was created during a time when the U.S. had slavery. Now, shoes don't mean anything to me. They don't remind me of anything. I don't think anything of them. And I think on some level, aren't we amazingly lucky that this is the kind of racism we're talking about? Racist shoes? You know, there used to be people, like dogs were being sicked on people in the 60s when they were fighting for civil rights. Now your shoes are fighting for civil rights. So we have had an unbelievable upgrade. So bravo, America. Bravo. We've made it, sort of. Now we're kind of just looking for things to go wrong. Instead of it finding you, we're hunting it down. I guess that's progress. So they tell me. And I know there's people out there who have a certain narrative. So when a company like Nike does something that either fits their politics or goes against their politics, the reaction is predictable. And Nike knows that. So they know when they put something polarizing out there, they know that these two groups are reliably going to do their marketing for them. So there's really no money to spend. You get all this free marketing, all this free coverage in every newspaper because everyone goes ballistic, or at least the people who are constantly on Twitter and social media and prone to just going off. But here's what Nike knows. One is youth is much more swayed by ads and progressive issues than older people. Older people's habits are pretty much set. And also their spending is going to shrink. They're not suddenly becoming athletes. I mean, yeah, there's a few people, you know, like Richard Branson gets bored because he's completely out of stuff to do and girls to have sex with. Oh, I'm sorry. He's a married man. I forget. So he's a guy who is bored. So he's probably going, which Nikes should I get? Because he's taking up new ways to hurt himself at this point. Whereas every other older person, once they hit, you know, their 40s or 50s, all their dreams of athleticism have died, and maybe for the best. The other thing that Nike knows is moderates don't care one way or the other. And most people are in the middle, which means they have a job, they're not online all day, they have families, they just don't care that much. So they're not really going to change their decision when they go to the mall with their kids and the kid wants some, you know, some cool new $100 sneaker. And safe ads are over. I went through this in the previous episode. There's no way to stand out being safe. You have to polarize. It's too crowded and you have to choose your polarity. Are you going to be the plus on the battery or the minus? And also there's a subtle, stealthy signaling to female customers and to employees and to minorities. They're saying, hey, we're the good guys. You want to work for us. You want to buy from us. We're going to treat you fairly. So there is this subtext beneath the, what is it, overtext? Subtext? And then is it just text or is there like overtext? Anyway, so some grammarian, get in touch with me. And also they realize that politics is religion. So they know that all of these people are going to be working for free, sharecropping all of their marketing messages for them. And a little bit more cynically, young people in general, and this is a generalization, I know there's some really smart ones, but they're not really analyzing that deeply. I wrote a whole piece on whether startups should be charitable or not. And there's a superficial level of charitability that feels good. It just feels right. You buy a pair of shoes here and a kid somewhere else gets a shoe. They only get one shoe. That you have to check the fine print. Seriously, that type of giving is insanely bad because it kills an industry that most emerging markets can do themselves. Anyone can make shoes. But instead, you're going to drop a bunch of free shoes on people. But there's enough companies that do these buy one, get one type programs or other stupid kinds of charitability. And no one really scratches beneath the surface. And for a good reason, it's a psychological reason. They don't want to know. Because if you dig a little bit deeper, you kind of know you're not going to like what you find. Same thing with bottled water. Same thing with all the stuff that I've been ranting and raving about. There's still this confusion out there that companies can be moral. Startups can be moral in the beginning. Small businesses can be moral. But once you get to corporate level and once you have shareholders and you're a public company, and you have this massive diffusion of accountability, you are amoral. You're acting in your best interest. Where the differences come in are you acting in your best interest today or some date in the future? So it's not whether or not you're being moral. You're always being amoral because profit is your motive. But the question is, how will you get to the most profit? Are you short-sighted or long-sighted? Is that another word I made up? Long, far-sighted. Thank you. So if you're more far-sighted, then you might think taking progressive stances in the long term, that's great for your brand. But if you're trying to make the numbers this quarter, you're probably not going to make as many waves. So really, it's just a matter of perspective. And different executives and different executive teams are going to interpret that differently. And so here we are with the sides breaking out exactly as predicted. And other companies are going to start doing this too. In fact, some of them already are. We saw that with the Gillette campaign where they basically lectured guys about how horrible they are. And then there was the Dove campaign, which it tells you how beautiful you are. So there's a lot of people being told something that brings out an emotional response, whether that emotional response is positive or negative. Either way, it gets in the, you know, in all the blogs and on social media, mission accomplished. The next thing I want to talk about is San Francisco. Man, I used to love San Francisco. I had a job offer from, I think it was Deloitte, back in 99, and then I ended up taking a job here instead. But I was in love with the city. I loved the hills. I loved the fact that you could walk, not everywhere, but it was just, it had so much character. It's changed so much over the last 20 years. This is a place that has filled up with tech industry people, and it's also amplified a lot of the inherent douchiness that existed before. An example is this e-cigarette ban. Now, San Francisco today, you can walk down Market Street and some of the main areas. You will see throngs of homeless everywhere, everywhere. There is human feces everywhere. You're playing hopscotch just to walk down the street. And if you have bad balance, you are going. And so it is awful. The crazy thing is, California just legalized marijuana. So you can have all the marijuana you want. And yet, inhaling a little vapor, we can't have any of that. What message are we sending? Are people free to make their own decisions about what they want and don't want to do? Are they not free? And the other question is, why aren't you just taxing it? If you tax it, you can raise a fortune to help the people that are on the streets. Now, I've seen some really compelling information that the homeless problem isn't just a homeless problem that, oh, suddenly these people can't afford homes. This is a mental health and drug problem. I think it was the homeless organization in Seattle. They estimate that about 80% of the homeless that they work with have some sort of addiction problem, whether it's alcohol or drugs, you know, it could be hard drugs or pills. So this is a serious thing because look, it's a far fall. Like even if rent goes up by 20%, most people who don't have some sort of deeper problem would find another home or they have family members who would take them in. But if you fall that far, that fast, there are other problems at play. And so instead of taking this money and helping these people, you're going to ban the thing and you're going to leave all that on the table. It's insanity. It is complete insanity. It's a complete disregard for what seem like values, but they're not. There aren't values here. There's a certain judgmental, preachy quality to this legislation. I can't put my finger on it, but there's a certain passive aggressiveness to it. And I think that's endemic of San Francisco in general. So sorry if you're listening in San Francisco. And I'm kind of excluding the tech bros because realistically, San Francisco is just a backdrop for them. They're kind of libertarian and they're not of that place. But the difference that I've noticed between New York and San Francisco, New York, the people are hard. They're a little bit dickish and they are aggressive because they know that it's up to them to survive, to make it here. In San Francisco, people are soft, so they're passive aggressive and they expect others to do for them. They expect the government to do for them. They don't take it upon themselves. There's a distance between the person and the accountability. They want the government to tell them what to do because they see government as an enforcer of their morality. And their morality is all over the map because their morality is, I think, deadbeat dads score a lot lower than secondhand smokers in their morality matrix. And so you see that with pot too. Oh, pot is this good thing that can heal all people and so peaceful. But oh, those dirty, dirty smokers and anything that they smoke that's even resembling cigarettes, we're going to have to crush because clearly these are immoral people. You see bits and pieces of that here in New York too. an aggressive or even a normal person, if let's say someone was spreading their legs on the subway or had their bags on the side and you wanted to sit down, you would just tell them, hey, you mind if I sit down? And 99.9% of the time, the person would just take the bags off or move their legs. But a passive aggressive person, they would take a photograph of that person, post it on Instagram and shame them and say, look at this man spreader or bag spreader or whatever other hashtag you could come up with. And so instead of just getting the seat and having a normal human interaction, because we're all sharing the same space and the same planet, instead you'd rather shame the person because of your own anger at the world or something. I really don't understand the psychology, but that psychology played out over the size of an entire city creates San Francisco. They'd rather tattle on you to the warden than take a shiv and and take their enemies down like you're supposed to. And look, you know, we're going to see rival gangs all over San Francisco. They're going to be selling black market vapes, and they're going to be selling contraband straws, and then they're going to be having dance battles steps away from legal marijuana dispensaries. Which, by the way, I'm sure there's some genius somewhere in California who's going, hey, you know what? CBD oil can solve all of this. If you just sprinkle 6 drops on a homeless person, they will stop being homeless and they will qualify to work for Google. And I'm sure that study's coming out sometime in the year 2180. And speaking of values, we are entering a very different era. We're entering a multipolar world. What does that mean? The US for a long time was the global superpower because Russia kind of disappeared. I mean, what's the last Russian product you've used? I mean, they're probably a mail order bride as everyone's trying to get out of there. So there is no Russian product except for military equipment, which is what they sell to the Middle East and all these other countries just to, you know, make a few bucks, create some trouble. But China now is on the rise, India too, but to a lesser extent. I don't think they have it together as much at the central government level. So really, it's about China emerging as a counterbalance to the US. And this whole process is being accelerated by the Trump administration. Whatever your opinions are on Trump, you could like him, you could hate him. But when Trump imposes tariffs, or when he meets with North Korea by himself, or meets with all these other countries and tries to break us out of treaties, for example, or breaks us out of Paris. Whether you agree with his decision or not, that separates us from our allies in Europe and Australia and Japan, all these countries that, first of all, have worked with us, second of all, have given us leverage and could have provided unbelievable leverage when dealing with China and the tariff situation. And thirdly, they rely on us for defense. Realistically, the reason Europe can afford universal healthcare or sometimes single payer is because they don't have to pay for a military. We do that. So they know under NATO, we're going to be covering that. And I think Trump made a fair point. They should be paying more. It's something I wrote about long before Trump was even running. In 2011, I wrote this in Econovation. They're not paying their fair share. Even though we've been drifting in this direction, even under Obama and maybe to some extent under Bush when we did the Iraq War, I think Trump just verbalized what was happening already, which is we are on our own. And by the way, losers, you're on your own too. And he's the only guy who's actually said it. And this is the truth. Now everyone's playing a game of Survivor where they know that alone they're exposed. So they're trying to create all of these alliances to survive. And the TPP, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a trade agreement that Obama put together, a lot of people didn't like. Trump blew it up and it fell through. But that was an opportunity to create a counterbalance in Asia by partnering with all of these countries that are afraid of Chinese influence. And now a lot of them are being forced to either ally with China or find some other bigger partner that can protect them and give them the products that they want and the protection that they need. So we've set off a very complicated chain of events. Now China is creating all these alliances in South America. That's not good for us either. It's actually kind of similar to what happened when the U.S. invaded Iraq. Every despot all over the world go, oh my God, I better get nukes, because nukes are the only way to keep myself from getting stabbed in the ass on the streets and then having it streamed all over social media. And if that's the world we're creating, nations are going to have to run for cover. So they're going to run into the hands of Russia, some of them, because they can protect them. Some of them are going to go to China. And some would probably like to go back to the U.S. if we'd let them, which we're not. At least not at this point. There's a really interesting article in The Economist talking about this future multipolar world. And the guy, the author of the book that they were talking about, has some really interesting points. And he thinks that there are going to be three main poles. There's going to be the Chinese sphere of influence. There's going to be the U.S. sphere of influence. And there's going to be the European one. I agree on two of those, the U.S. and China. I don't agree on Europe. Europe doesn't have the military. No one is scared of the Danish. More people are scared of actual Danishes than the Danish. You know how many calories are in those things? And Europe, they don't have the cohesiveness with UK bailing out and all these diverging interests. And they're dying off. Their populations are getting old. So they don't present a viable force. The other thing that I know for sure is democracy is now officially decoupled from capitalism. That means that you can be capitalist like China and not even be remotely democratic. So you're just in it for the money and they're going to tell you what to do and they're going to do pretty well. When the U.S. was the dominant country, it was like, oh, you need democracy to have effective capitalism because you're empowering the individual and all this other stuff. But that's not necessarily the case anymore. The problem is that the countries that do democratic capitalism, we're lagging behind dealing with high concentrations of capital and power, with low birth rates, with high debt levels. These are all things that happen in late stage capitalism, but the government needs to adjust and the regulations need to adjust, and they haven't. That's why you see all the socialist ideas becoming popular again. They're frustrated with the reality that legislation and the government isn't keeping up with the marketplace, with their own experience. They can feel that they're not earning as much as they should be or as a select few companies are. And I could show you charts that prove it. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter, because the reality is that 72 or 73% of the economy is represented by the top 500 companies. That is a fact. And fewer people represent the wealth of the country. That's absolutely true. So now the question is, well, how do you redistribute it in a fair way? And how do you break the incumbencies that are keeping the system the way they are? And what's fair? What should the government be providing? We're doing a really crappy job answering any of those questions. And I don't think either party has the right answers. Well, the Republicans aren't really interested. But the Democrats, I'd prefer that they did more thinking than pandering. But yes, they see the problem. I just don't think they have the right solutions. All right, back to international policy. The worst case scenario would be Russia somehow partnering up with Europe. And this is what worries me, because Russia has only one thing to offer. It's like those shelves that you've seen in Venezuela where you go into the store and there's just like one item or one brand of item across the entire store. They've got one item, and that item is military force. And the worst case scenario is the place that's missing force, the rest of Europe, tying up with Russia to get that counterbalance. That's why we, who still value Western ideals, and I'm talking about individual and civil liberties, freedom of speech and freedom of the press, human rights, all of these things which we don't always live up to, but we aspire to them. We always have. And people who value those things have to push back hard on countries that don't aspire to those values. Or before you know it, we're going to have a social credit system here. And, you know, that's the app that basically tracks your entire life and face scans you in China and knows exactly where you are at all times. And at this moment in China, you are being judged based on what you buy, who you hang out with, what time of day you're out. Everything is matched up based on your face, your activity on your phone. And there are millions of people right now who are banned from traveling because they owe money or because they got a low score in the system. Do you want a country with those values to dominate global trade or to influence other nations? That's what we have to fight for. And when I say fight, I don't mean war. I mean, win the battle of ideas. We are past the stage where we can claim American exceptionalism and call it a day. No, those days are over. We have way too many problems to say, oh, we could just lean back and we're the greatest country and everyone can show up. No, we have to prove yet again that we have the best answers, that we have the best ideas, that we have the best innovations. We have to re-earn our exceptionalism. Which brings me to my final point. What the hell are we? What are we? We're sitting around hoping a fake video doesn't wipe us off the planet. We're begging for Snoop Dogg to call us for no apparent reason. We don't know the guy. We're trying to digitally strip Scarlett Johansson or Jake Gyllenhaal naked so we could spank ourselves into some weird sterility. And we're going to kill off the very thing that gave the world prosperity. Capitalism by being too stubborn and stupid to fix the democracy that made it useful. And I say that with no hesitation. This is the only country that defeated the world in a world war and didn't carve it up and murder everybody and take all their stuff. In fact, we did the opposite. We funded not only our allies after the war, but our enemies. That is unprecedented. That has never happened in the history of war. So let's not live in denial of our exceptionalism, but let's also recognize that that was a long time ago and it's time to re-earn it. And you know what's not going to help us re-earn it? Being dumb reactionaries. Whenever there's a commercial, predictably, like dumb monkeys, we jump and go, ooh, I'm going to take this side. I'm going to take that side. No one's thinking. Everyone's reacting. What are we? What do we value? And you see all of these politicians and they have their piecemeal ideas. Oh, I'm going to give you free this, or I'm going to give free that, or I'm going to block these people from coming in, or I'm going to let all these people coming in. Whatever it is, what are we? What are the values we judge these things against? How do you know if something is good or bad if you don't have a set of values to judge it by? Years ago, I wrote a piece called Fire Them All, about how to get campaign finance reform. So we could at least, if we can't get brilliant people into government, at least we could get honest people into government who aren't being paid off by corporations. So in that article, which I'll link to as well, I listed 8 of the biggest problems that we have to solve. But I think we need more. I think there's probably a list of 10 that we need to focus on. And what I would love to see is for all of us as Americans to agree, what are those problems? And also, which ones should reside at the federal level or the state level or the city level, and who's accountable for doing it? In some cases, it should be the government. In other cases, it should be the individual or corporations. But we need to decide these. This is a table I'm talking about. I'm talking about a table that has, here are our priorities over here, and here's who's going to do it across the top, and we just write in what the metric is. That's all we need to do. But no one's having this conversation. In fact, we're having a retarded conversation. Yes, in the classical sense, to retard means to hold back progress. Do you remember JFK's classic speech when he said,
"And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you.
Strength and sacrifice? Who are you kidding, JFK? No politician could ever survive telling you need to do something. It's all about what the country should do for you. There's never, ever any talk about what you can do for the country. This one-way street is a dead end. It's an abdication of accountability. It sends the wrong message. It puts everyone on mental welfare. Who exactly are we helping by saying, hey, you just lay back and enjoy your deep fake porn while government takes care of the rest? I mean, it may take us a while. It may take us like 30, 40 years of promises before something actually affects you. In the meantime, you get yourself plenty of paper towels because I know it's going to get real moist up in this piece. We're basically in a constitutional crisis, except we have a bunch of dummies we can't trust to fix and rewrite the Constitution because they're all corrupt or have no vision and aren't nearly as well-read as the founding fathers. So who are you going to trust? These people? The chairman of the Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, was interrogating bank executives. Here, listen to this clip yourself. If this doesn't drive you up a wall, I don't know what will. Remember, chairwoman of the Financial Services Committee, talking to bank executives.
This is student loan crisis. $1.56 trillion in student loan debt. Last month, this committee received testimony that last year, 1 million student loan borrowers defaulted, which is on top of the 1 million borrowers who defaulted the year before. What are you guys doing to help us with this student loan debt? Who would like to answer first? Mr. Monahan, Big Bank.
We stopped making student loans in 2007 or so.
Oh, so you don't do it anymore, Mr. Corbett?
We exited student lending in 2009.
Mr. Diamond?
When the government took over student lending in 2010 or so, we stopped doing all student lending.
Thank you.
She didn't know that the government took over 100% of all student loans. This is the person who heads up financial services. We are doomed if these are the people you're going to trust to save us. But okay, let's at least start by agreeing on the priorities. The debt is over $22 trillion. And the three things that are driving our debt are entitlement programs, military, and ironically, interest payments. The second thing is employment, wages, and economic growth. I think we've been doing pretty well in economic growth. Wages have been starting to go up a little bit. Unemployment is at an all-time low. However, there's still a bunch of people that are out of the workforce. So there are things to solve on this issue and probably a lot more when I wrote the article, but that's clearly something we should be focused on and that our politicians need to be measured on. Not just the number of jobs, but the quality of the jobs that are created. The next thing is poverty. There's 47 million Americans on food stamps. That's too many. So we have to figure it out. And I blame both parties. Republicans don't even pretend to care. I mean, there's a certain honesty to that where they're like, we just like our donors and we're going to just try to find tax cuts for them, which is fine. That's what they believe. And if people keep voting them in, well, then you got to deal with it. And then the Democrats, they trot out all kinds of big talk about poverty and nothing changes. Nothing changes. It's only been growing and their policies don't work and they never admit that they don't work. I wrote a whole piece on that. I'm going to link to that as well. Social Security and other entitlement programs. You know, there's so much talk about all these new programs. The millionaires and the billionaires will be funding free education. Great, Bernie. Love it. Just a quick question. you know Social Security is going to be insolvent in a few years, right? So how are you going to fix that?
Do not bother me with these details. I am here shopping for a comb. I have not had a comb for 25 years, and you do not disturb me with the details. When there are so many people waiting, just waiting for me to forgive their debts. All of the decisions they made were terrible, and I'm going to forgive them, like Jesus or Santa Claus or something. Now, get out of my way. I need to find hair gel. It gets very windy during the debates. I need to keep my locks down.
I'm so rooting for Bernie to win because that's the only impression I do out of any of the candidates. Either I need to get to work or I need to raise a ton of money for this guy. So the one big government program we do have that touches everybody is going insolvent. We can't fix that. So how are we going to add new programs? Who's believing this stuff? What kind of delusion are we under? Let's fix this one. It can be done. The other thing is healthcare costs, and they're absolutely out of control. I did an entire 6-episode series on it. Go check it out. There are ways to solve it. It's not either, oh, it's 100% of market good, like Republicans talk about, and it's not like, oh, government has to take it over. That's not the only answer. There's a lot of middle ground that's much, much better. Education. It's a mess. And not just higher education, all education. That's something we need to talk about. And maybe not at the federal level. Maybe that's something that needs to be punted down to states or cities. When I made the original list, I had our growing prison population listed as one of the problems. But we just passed a major prison reform bill, which is actually very encouraging because it shows that left and right can work together. And a big part of it is the failed drug war. We've militarized something that's a medical problem and to some extent a trade or import problem. All of these things are fixable, but we have to just agree on what the priorities are and what the vision is. Who is having that conversation? The eighth and final thing that I had in the original list was foreign policy. And I talked a lot about this in the multipolar conversation. But we've got a bunch of other stuff going on. We've got spying. We've got drones. We've got the NSA. We've got all of these things going on. What are the values that we want to espouse today? And then we can decide what priorities make sense and what metrics make sense. You can't decide on individual policies until you agree on what your values are. Let's have that conversation without accusations, without venom. We should just have it. The thing that I would add to it probably is climate change, but I think in a different way than others think about it, because realistically, the U.S. is only 14% of the world's energy consumption. So if anything happens on climate, we can be leaders and we can provide technology and we can provide R&D money. But at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the rest of the world to adopt this stuff because they're the 86%. And our percentage is shrinking because populations in India and China are growing fast. And in Econovation and some of the articles I wrote in Business Insider around 2012, I proposed a bunch of solutions. I talked about how we build a capital magnet, a country that other countries want to invest in, how to create makers within our country, and how to educate people differently so they're oriented not towards consumption, but creation. Third thing I talk about is creating micropreneurs, people who can exist as individual businesses and have the platforms and tools available to them to do that. The fourth thing was incentives. How do you use economic and behavioral incentives to get the kinds of behaviors you want? A perfect example is the vaping ban, because you can drop the use of vaping with a tax while at the same time using that disincentive and using that tax to help another problem that's hurting all these people. The other thing is bringing all of these foreign manufacturers here. And that's something that Trump has talked about and tried doing, but it's just been so disjointed that it's hard to say that it's part of his strategy. Unlike states competing for companies, us competing with other countries is actually a net gain. And I talked about other things like capital parity, which I'll put a link to the article. If I were approaching this problem today, I would start with values and aspirations. What do we want to be? And I know it's not average. I know it's not middle class. I know there's a lot of talk out there about the dream of middle class. I think poor people maybe aspire to that. But I think we're in a position where we could aim higher. And certainly the people who are coming out of universities should be aiming higher. And instead of focusing their energies on redistributing wealth, I wish they would dedicate at least as much energy, or hopefully double the energy, to creating wealth and creating value. And I truly believe the tools are out there. I believe that we can build businesses that don't steal from other businesses, or that don't take away opportunities from others, but create opportunities. All the stuff that we have is stuff we don't need. Think about all this podcast, all the equipment that it's on, your phone. None of this stuff is necessary. We had perfectly good lives without any of it. All of this stuff is a perk. Everything we do, everything we consume, everything we use except for food, clothing, and shelter is a luxury good. All of those things were invented and created, poof, out of thin air. We have the capacity to do more of that, 10 times more of that. Make something other people want. And hopefully they're good things. Maybe kale. You can give them kale. Or you can give them, you know, exercise equipment. Or you could give them yoga classes. Whatever it is that you're capable of providing. We create value. The world of scarcity is over. We can feed everybody. And we are feeding everybody. The statistics, if you look at them carefully, are extremely encouraging. Yes, we should have better allocation of resources. We should have better allocation of opportunity, of course. But I wish all of the people in politics were having a conversation about three things. What are our values? What are our aspirations? And how do we create value for each other? That's it. I'm Steve Factor. See you next week on The McFuture. Don't forget, share, subscribe. Please review the show on iTunes if you're on iTunes, and sign up for the Patreon to get bonus material. I'm going to be putting up a lot of bonus stuff over the next couple of months. I will see you next week on The McFuture.